Welcome to Food for Thought. My name is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau from Compassionate Cooks. I founded Compassionate Cooks to empower people to make informed food choices and to debunk myths about veganism and animal rights. I do this in a number of ways, through cooking classes, through articles and essays, workshops and lectures. I have a cooking DVD, a CD we put out pretty recently, and I have my cookbooks, The Joy of Vegan Baking and The Vegan Table, and of course, this podcast. You can learn more about who we are and what we do by visiting our website, CompassionateCooks.com. Hello, everybody. It's nice to be here, and I hope you're all doing well. Today's podcast sponsor is actually a gift sponsorship from Justin Mora on behalf of his wife, Beatrice, for her birthday. Justin gave Beatrice a Compassionate Cooks membership, and in doing so, he sponsored this podcast, and he did so on behalf of Beatrice. So I'll let him explain in his own words, because the email he wrote is quite lovely. So Justin wrote, "I would like to dedicate this podcast to my lovely wife, Beatrice, for her birthday and for being the most wonderful, beautiful, compassionate, and joyful vegan I have ever met. She is the one who opened my eyes to this new world of healthful and compassionate living and has been a passionate activist for animal rights. Once we found out how the animals were being treated, we could no longer be part of the senseless torture and killing of animals. And ever since we have stopped consuming animal products, we've never been more healthy or happy in our lives. This newfound freedom of not having the weight of the pain and suffering and blood on my hands has inspired us to become more active in drawing attention to our senseless slaughter of billions of innocent and beautiful lives, all for the sake of destroying ourselves and the planet. And I owe all of this to her. We often have discussions about if what we're doing makes a difference, and it gets frustrating when we're confronted with it every day. But whenever we start feeling hopeless and down, we just listen to one of your podcasts, and your soft-spoken, logical, and intelligent thoughts give us hope and inspiration to continue on this path, fighting for animal rights and a healthier and just society. Your podcast gave us the knowledge, information, and ideas on how to have discussions with our family and friends that are more civilized and less threatening and make them more receptive to becoming vegan. Being the joyful vegans we are, my father-in-law has seen the wonderful benefits of a vegan lifestyle and has also stopped eating animal products and lost 40 pounds and is no longer taking medication for his high blood pressure. Again, it was the compassion and love that Beatrice so elegantly spoke with that allowed the seeds for change to take root and for the truth to shine through. I believe all of us on this earth would like to live a life without causing harm to any sentient being and leave the planet in a better state than when they found it. Beatrice gives me the courage and strength to continue fighting for that peace every day, and with her by my side, I feel that anything is possible. I never thought I would be where I am today, and without her, I'm not sure I would have found the path, which is why I believe she came into my life. At the end of the day, it's not about Beatrice and I. It's about the animals who have no voice. Without them, there is no us. I'm so grateful to have Beatrice in my life, for myself, the animals, and the earth. Thank you." Thank you very much, Justin, and happy birthday, Beatrice, and thank you both for listening and living with such purpose and justice and kindness and for spreading the word. The world really is a better place because you're in it. So thank you for letting me be part of that. If you would like to sponsor this podcast on behalf of yourself or someone else as a gift, please consider becoming a member. You can become a member making a one-time annual membership payment, or you can do that monthly. Either way, it supports our work and it helps us continue being a voice for the animals, both human and non-human. So check out CompassionateCooks.com to join the club. I also want to thank you all of you listeners, for your votes in the Veg News Veggie Awards. I'll probably make this announcement a couple times in subsequent episodes, but our podcast won Favorite Podcast in the 2009 Veggie Awards, and that was really thanks to you. So I'm very happy. I'm very proud of this podcast, and I'm equally grateful to all of you who voted. So now we are officially an award-winning podcast. frankly, I'm rewarded every day when I hear from listeners telling me how the podcast changed their lives. It's pretty rewarding work, but it's certainly nice to be validated by the masses. So thank you, everybody who voted and who voted for this podcast. And finally, I want to just make this announcement because I've started putting out little previews out online, but come 2010, it looks like I'll be adding video podcasts to my list of endeavors. I'm still working out the details, but I wanted to just point you to some of the preview clips filmed by the very talented Brett Renville of Leaning Wolf Productions, leaningwolf.com. Brett is a podcast listener. He's also a very talented filmmaker. And I'm hoping that we can do some things together to get these video podcasts off the ground. So you can go to CompassionateCooks.com right now to watch these clips. I believe we have them under writings/podcast, that menu item. And I think I call it video clips or video podcast. The videos are also up on YouTube. So if you want, you can subscribe to my videos on YouTube, and then you'll be notified every time a new one comes out. So right now I'm just releasing one little preview clip every week or so, and then I plan to actually move to an actual feed when it becomes an actual podcast. So I thought you'd like to know. You'll hear some of the things that you've heard in this podcast on this particular, in these clips that I've released. It was part of an interview that Brett had done for a film he was making. So check it out. Let me know what you think. Certainly let me know if you have any thoughts about it, and I'm pretty excited about it. It's not going to replace this audio podcast. It's just going to be in addition to it, and we're going to be doing some fun things that I think really make it more conducive to a video podcast, including some cooking, some animals. We're going to actually be with some animals, and just a bunch of different things. So certainly give me your thoughts about that. I'm definitely open to that. So thanks, everybody. Thanks for listening and for voting and subscribing and sponsoring the podcast. It's time to get to our reading for the day. Now, you might remember a story I read not so long ago called A Dog's Tale by Mark Twain. And I talked about how he was an advocate for animals, and he spoke openly against such things as bullfighting and vivisection. And wouldn't you know, a beautiful book has just come out called Mark Twain's Book of Animals. It's hot off the press. I just got a copy myself, and I love it. It's published by the University of California Press, and it's edited with notes and afterword and introduction by Shelley Fisher Fishkin, who is a professor of literature at Stanford. And there are these beautiful illustrations throughout the book by Barry Moser. It's gorgeous. It's a beautiful book that I've added to my Amazon store, so you can definitely find it there, and I definitely encourage you to check it out. It's full of essays and excerpts and letters and short stories, some of which are published for the first time in this book called Mark Twain's Book of Animals. His dedication to animal advocacy and his indignance about injustices and abuses committed against animals increases as he gets older, and you can really see that in his writings. But animals were really part of his writing from the very first story that earned him renown, which I mentioned in that last episode, a story called The Celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, up until pieces, some of which were published and some of which were left unpublished, that he wrote until his death in 1910. His aversion to animal abuse existed for its own sake, but Twain is also known for becoming more and more disillusioned about his country in particular and pessimistic about humankind in general as he gets older. And this is reflected in quite a few works, all of which are included in this book. And I'm going to read two of them today. I'm going to read an excerpt from one of them today, and I'm going to read the entire essay of another. But there are also other ones called The Victims, written in the early 1900s. One called The Jungle Discusses Man, he wrote in 1902. The Edisons of the Animal World in 1906. And of course, the anti-vivisection story that I read a few months ago called A Dog's Tale. He also wrote a story called A Horse's Tale. There's also A Cat's Tale in the compilation here. A Horse's Tale was written in 1905 at the behest of animal welfare activist and actress Minnie Mattern Fisk. And in the introduction to the book, Fishkin tells us that, quote, Fisk was a militant animal welfare activist who protested issues ranging from the steel traps used to capture animals for fur coats to the treatment of mules in oil fields. She forbade other actresses appearing with her on stage to wear furs or feather-decorated hats, off stage or on, and she was known for collecting stray cats in towns in which she played while on tour. And so after reading A Dog's Tale, Fisk urged Twain to write something about the horses killed in the Spanish bull ring, which he does, and that's called A Horse's Tale. So that's all pretty cool. I thought that was pretty neat. So the essay I'm going to read is called Man's Place in the Animal World. It's similar in content to letters from a dog to another dog explaining and accounting for man, though the latter is decidedly lighter in tone, as evident by the full title. The full title is Letters from a Dog to Another Dog Explaining and Accounting for Man by author Newfoundland Smith, get it, translated from the original doggerel by MT. So I'm going to read a little of that one first, and then I'm going to read the full essay of Man's Place in the Animal World, and I hope you like both. Let's start with the first one, and I'm going to read the beginning. It's broken up into little chapters. It's a very short piece, but it's still broken up into little chapters. So I'll just read at least the first chapter here. I'm just reading it so that you can compare it to the other one. So it begins, Dear St. Bernard. Now remember, this is written by Newfoundland Smith. There's a beautiful illustration of a Newfoundland dog, actually. So it begins, Dear St. Bernard, the questions you ask me are hard to answer, but I will try. I understand the matter perfectly myself, for I have devoted my whole life to the closest study of it, but I'm not sure that I can convey to another fully and clearly all I know. As a help to my attempt, I must ask you to sponge your mind clear of prejudice, ostensible information, and dogly tradition concerning man and what he is, and for why he was invented, and whether he is worthwhile. In a word, make yourself a puppy again, with all which that implies of receptivity and hospitable welcome to any new thing. Now then, I begin. I begin by placing before you this maxim, so to call it, and with it the requirement that you accept it and force yourself to believe it. All things considered, a man is as good as a dog. Be patient. Notice the qualification, all things considered. I claim and do honestly believe that it is chiefly man's environment that makes him ridiculous, and not, as has always been taught and believed, his fundamental incapacity to be otherwise than ridiculous. I claim that a dog placed in man's situation and hampered by the myriad pathetic slaveries to which he is subject from his cradle would gradually and surely deteriorate and at last turn into a thing which would be, to all intents and purposes, a man. Take just one detail, for example, to start with. No man has ever possessed that common and inviolable heritage of our race, freedom of conscience, freedom of speech, and freedom of action. I ask you, what would a dog be without these? Where would his character be? How could he have a character at all with nothing to build it on? Imagine yourself so situated that while holding views of your own, you must pretend to hold the views of your neighbors, bark in your party's key, or your church's key, or your monarch's key, or bark not at all. And as for the freedom of action, why, a man's cook can put limits to that. Now there you have, in a nutshell, the thing, at least the most important thing, which differentiates man from dog. To speak broadly, one might perhaps say, give a man freedom of conscience, freedom of speech, freedom of action, and he is a dog. Take them from a dog, and he is a man. Then he goes on a little bit more and goes on and on and on. And he goes on to chapter 4, I think is interesting. He gets interrupted by a little dog. And then he goes on and says, but I was saying when interrupted, if we stop a moment to consider, man's new claim is obviously untenable. It would be the reverse of difficult to show that in true nobleness and fineness of character, his stage of development is far below that of the other animals. Let us note a few particulars in this connection. Malice resides in no animal but one, man. Envy is found in no animal but one, man. Ambition deforms and defiles the character of no animal but one, man. Lust of vengeance for old treasured injury is found in the character of no animal but one, man. Cruelty, the inflicting of pain upon the feelings or the body for the mere pleasure of inflicting it, is an infamous characteristic which is found in no animal but one, man. Murder, all animals kill, but only man murders. Immodesty, this is restricted to man, no other animal has it. Base spirit, boot-licking servility. These degradations are found in the characters of no animals but two, man and the dog. And the dog was free of them until he took comradeship with man. Slavery, no animal inflicts it but man and the ant. No animal endures it with contentment and transmits it to his posterity without shame but man alone. Captivity, mutilation, and death for opinion's sake. No animal has had experience of this sort but one, man. This creature has invented a heaven, and from it has excluded all the animals but himself. Our own philosophy has always taught that man was on his tedious and patient way upward toward the moral heights attained by the other animals, with a considerable distance to climb yet, and so far I see nothing the matter with that theory. And he goes on, but I think that gets to the gist of what he then expands on in the other essay, which I'm going to read right now. And that one is called Man's Place in the Animal World. Okay, so this essay starts off with just a brief note that says page one of the manuscript containing telegrams has been lost. So this is a reference that Mark Twain makes in the essay. Mark Twain copied out the following quotations from identified sources on pages 2 and 3 of the manuscript. So here's something that Mark Twain copies out before he starts his essay. In August 1572, similar things were occurring in Paris and elsewhere in France. In this case, it was Christian against Christian. The Roman Catholics, by previous concert, sprung a surprise upon the unprepared and unsuspecting Protestants and butchered them by thousands, both sexes and all ages. This was the memorable St. Bartholomew's Day. At Rome, the Pope and the Church gave public thanks to God when the happy news came. During several centuries, hundreds of heretics were burned at the stake every year because their religious opinions were not satisfactory to the Roman Church. In all ages, the savage of all lands have made the slaughtering of their neighboring brothers and the enslaving of their women and children the common business of their lives. Hypocrisy, envy, malice, cruelty, vengefulness, seduction, rape, robbery, swindling, arson, bigamy, adultery, and the oppression and humiliation of the poor and the helpless in all ways have been and still are more or less common among both the civilized and uncivilized peoples of the earth. For many centuries, the, quote, common brotherhood of man, end quote, has been urged on Sundays, and, quote, patriotism, end quote, on Sundays and weekdays both. Yet patriotism contemplates the opposite of a common brotherhood. Woman's equality with man has never been conceded by any people, ancient or modern, civilized or savage. So that's the quote he had first, and then he begins. I have been scientifically studying the traits and dispositions of the, quote, lower animals, so-called, and contrasting them with the traits and dispositions of man. I find the result profoundly humiliating to me, for it obliges me to renounce my allegiance to the Darwinian theory of the ascent of man from the lower animals, since it now seems plain to me that the theory ought to be vacated in favor of a new and truer one, this new and truer one to be named the descent of man from the higher animals. In proceeding toward this unpleasant conclusion, I have not guessed or speculated or conjectured, but have used what is commonly called the scientific method. That is to say, I have subjected every postulate that presented itself to the crucial test of actual experiment, and have adopted it or rejected it according to the result. Thus, I verified and established each step of my course in its turn before advancing to the next. These experiments were made in the London Zoological Gardens and covered many months of painstaking and fatiguing work. Before particularizing any of the experiments, I wish to state one or two things which seem to more properly belong in this place than further along. This, in the interest of clearness, the massed experiments established to my satisfaction certain generalizations, to wit. 1. That the human race is of one distinct species. It exhibits slight variations in color, stature, mental caliber, and so on, due to climate, environment, and so forth, but it is a species by itself and not to be confounded with any other. 2. That the quadrupeds are a distinct family also. This family exhibits variations in color, size, food preferences, and so on, but it is a family by itself. 3. That the other families, the birds, the fishes, the insects, the reptiles, etc., are more or less distinct also. They are in the procession. They are links in the chain which stretches down from the higher animals to man at the bottom. Some of my experiments were quite curious. In the course of my reading, I had come across a case where, many years ago, some hunters on our great plains organized a buffalo hunt for the entertainment of an English earl. That, and to provide some fresh meat for his larder. They had charming sport. They killed 72 of those great animals and ate part of one of them and left the 71 to rot. In order to determine the difference between an anaconda and an earl, if any, I caused 7 young calves to be turned into the anaconda's cage. The grateful reptile immediately crushed one of them and swallowed it, then lay back satisfied. It showed no further interest in the calves and no disposition to harm them. I tried this experiment with other anacondas, always with the same result. The fact stood proven that the difference between an earl and an anaconda is that the earl is cruel and the anaconda isn't, and that the earl wantonly destroys what he has no use for, but the anaconda doesn't. This seemed to suggest that the anaconda was not descended from the earl. It also seemed to suggest that the earl was descended from the anaconda and had lost a good deal in the transition. I was aware that many men who have accumulated more millions of money than they can ever use have shown a rabid hunger for more and have not scrupled to cheat the ignorant and the helpless out of their poor savings in order to partially appease that appetite. I furnished 100 different kinds of wild and tame animals the opportunity to accumulate vast stores of food, but none of them would do it. The squirrels and bees and certain birds made accumulations, but stopped when they had gathered a winter's supply and could not be persuaded to add to it either honestly or by chicane. In order to bolster up a tottering reputation, the ant pretended to store up supplies, but I was not deceived. I know the ant. These experiments convinced me that there is difference between man and the higher animals. He is avaricious and miserly. They are not. In the course of my experiments, I convinced myself that among the animals, man is the only one that harbors insults and injuries, broods over them, waits till a chance offers, then takes revenge. The passion of revenge is unknown to the higher animals. Roosters keep harems, but it is by consent of their concubines, therefore no wrong is done. Men keep harems, but it is by brute force, privileged by atrocious laws, which the other sex were allowed no hand in making. In this matter, man occupies a far lower place than the rooster. Cats are loose in their morals, but not consciously so. Man, in his descent from the cat, has brought the cat's looseness with him, but has left the unconsciousness behind, the saving grace which excuses the cat. The cat is innocent. Man is not. Indecency, vulgarity, obscenity, these are strictly confined to man. He invented them. Among the higher animals, there is no trace of them. They hide nothing. They are not ashamed. Man, with his soiled mind, covers himself. He will not even enter a drawing room with his breast and back naked. So alive is he and his mates to indecent suggestion. Man is the animal that laughs. But so does the monkey, as Mr. Darwin pointed out, and so does the Australian bird that is called the laughing jackass. No, man is the animal that blushes. He is the only one that does it, or has occasion to. At the head of this article, we see how 3 monks were burnt to death a few days ago, and a prior put to death with atrocious cruelty. Do we inquire into the details? No. Or we should find out that the prior was subjected to unprintable mutilations. Man, when he is a North American Indian, gouges out his prisoner's eyes. When he is King John, with a nephew to render untroublesome, he uses a red-hot iron. When he is a religious zealot dealing with heretics in the Middle Ages, he skins his capture alive and scatters salt on his back. In the first Richard's time, he shuts up a multitude of Jew families in a tower and sets fire to it. In Columbus's time, he captures a family of Spanish Jews and... But that is not printable. In our day in England, a man is fined 10 shillings for beating his mother nearly to death with a chair, and another man is fined 40 shillings for having 4 pheasant eggs in his possession without being able to satisfactorily explain how he got them. Of all the animals, man is the only one that is cruel. He is the only one that inflicts pain for the pleasure of doing it. It is a trait that is not known to the higher animals. The cat plays with the frightened mouse, but she has this excuse, that she does not know that the mouse is suffering. The cat is moderate, unhumanly moderate. She only scares the mouse. She does not hurt it. She doesn't dig out its eyes or tear off its skin or drive splinters under its nails, man fashion. When she is done playing with it, she makes a sudden meal of it and puts it out of its trouble. Man is the cruel animal. He is alone in that distinction. The higher animals engage in individual fights, but never in organized masses. Man is the only animal that deals in that atrocity of atrocities, war. He is the only one that gathers his brethren around him and goes forth in cold blood and with calm pulse to exterminate his kind. He is the only animal that for sordid wages will march out, as the Hessians did in our revolution, and as the boyish Prince Napoleon did in the Zulu War, and help to slaughter strangers of his own species who have done him no harm and with whom he has no quarrel. Man is the only animal that robs his helpless fellow of his country, takes possession of it and drives him out or destroys him. Man has done this in all the ages. There is not an acre of ground on the globe that is in possession of its rightful owner, or that has not been taken away from owner after owner, cycle after cycle, by force and bloodshed. Man is the only slave, and he is the only animal who enslaves. He has always been a slave in one form or another, and has always held other slaves in bondage under him in one way or another. In our day, he is always some man's slave for wages, and does that man's work, and this slave has other slaves under him for minor wages, and they do his work. The higher animals are the only ones who exclusively do their own work and provide their own living. Man is the only patriot. He sets himself apart in his own country, under his own flag, and sneers at the other nations, and keeps multitudinous uniformed assassins on hand at heavy expense to grab slices of other people's countries, and keep them from grabbing slices of his. And in the intervals between campaigns, he washes the blood off his hands and works for the universal brotherhood of man with his mouth. Man is the religious animal. He is the only religious animal. He is the only animal that has the true religion, several of them. He is the only animal that loves his neighbor as himself and cuts his throat if his theology isn't straight. He has made a graveyard of the globe in trying his honest best to smooth his brother's path to happiness and heaven. He was at it in the time of the Caesars. He was at it in Mahomet's time. He was at it in the time of the Inquisition. He was at it in France a couple of centuries. He was at it in England in Mary's day. He has been at it ever since he saw the light. He is at it today in Crete, as per the telegrams quoted above. He will be at it somewhere else tomorrow. The higher animals have no religion, and we are told that they are going to be left out in the hereafter. I wonder why. It seems questionable taste. Man is the reasoning animal, such is the claim. I think it is open to dispute. Indeed, my experiments have proven to me that he is the unreasoning animal. Note his history, as sketched above. It seems plain to me that whatever he is not a reasoning animal. His record is the fantastic record of a maniac. I consider that the strongest count against his intelligence is the fact that with that record back of him, he blandly sets himself up as the head animal of the lot, whereas by his own standards, he is the bottom one. In truth, man is incurably foolish. Simple things which the other animals easily learn, he is incapable of learning. Among my experiments was this. In an hour, I taught a cat and a dog to be friends. I put them in a cage. In another hour, I taught them to be friends with a rabbit. In the course of 2 days, I was able to add a fox, a goose, a squirrel, and some doves. Finally, a monkey. They lived together in peace, even affectionately. Next, in another cage, I confined an Irish Catholic from Tipperary, and as soon as he seemed tame, I added a Scotch Presbyterian from Aberdeen. Next, a Turk from Constantinople, a Greek Christian from Crete, an Armenian, a Methodist from the wilds of Arkansas, a Buddhist from China, a Brahmin from Benares. Finally, a Salvation Army colonel from Wapping. Then I stayed away 2 whole days. When I came back to note results, the cage of higher animals was all right. But in the other, there was but a chaos of gory odds and ends of turbans and fezes and plaids and bones and flesh, not a specimen left alive. These reasoning animals had disagreed on a theological detail and carried the matter to a higher court. One is obliged to concede that in true loftiness of character, man cannot claim to approach even the meanest of the higher animals. It is plain that he is constitutionally incapable of approaching that altitude, that he is constitutionally afflicted with a defect which must make such approach forever impossible. For it is manifest that this defect is permanent in him, indestructible, ineradicable. I find this defect to be the moral sense. He is the only animal that has it. It is the secret of his degradation. It is the quality which enables him to do wrong. It has no other office. It is incapable of performing any other function. It could never have been intended to perform any other. Without it, man could do no wrong. He would rise at once to the level of the higher animals. Since the moral sense has but the one office, the one capacity to enable man to do wrong, it is plainly without value to him. It is as valueless to him as is disease. In fact, it manifestly is a disease. Rabies is bad, but it is not so bad as this disease. Rabies enables a man to do a thing which he could not do when in a healthy state, kill his neighbor with a poisonous bite. No one is the better for man having rabies. The moral sense enables a man to do wrong. It enables him to do wrong 1,000 ways. Rabies is an innocent disease compared to the moral sense. No one, then, can be the better man for having the moral sense. What now do we find the primal curse to have been? Plainly, what it was in the beginning, the infliction upon man of the moral sense, the ability to distinguish good from evil, and with it, necessarily, the ability to do evil, for there can be no evil act without the presence of consciousness of it in the doer of it. And so I find that we have descended and degenerated from some far ancestor, some microscopic atom wandering at its pleasure between the mighty horizons of a drop of water, perchance, insect by insect, animal by animal, reptile by reptile, down the long highway of smirchless innocence, till we have reached the bottom stage of development, nameable as the human being. Below us, nothing. Nothing but the Frenchman. There is only one possible stage below the moral sense. That is the immoral sense. The Frenchman has it. Man is but little lower than the angels. This definitely locates him. He is between the angels and the French. Oh, he's just so bad. Man seems to be a rickety, poor sort of thing. Any way you take him, a kind of British museum of infirmities and inferiorities. He is always undergoing repairs. A machine that was as unreliable as he is would have no market. On top of his specialty, the moral sense, are piled a multitude of minor infirmities, such a multitude indeed that one may broadly call them countless. The higher animals get their teeth without pain or inconvenience. Man gets his through months and months of cruel torture, and at a time of life when he is but ill able to bear it. As soon as he has got them, they must all be pulled out again, for they were of no value in the first place, not worth the loss of a night's rest. The second set will answer for a while by being reinforced occasionally with rubber or plugged up with gold, but he will never get a set which can really be depended on till a dentist makes him one. This set will be called false teeth, as if he had ever worn any other kind. In a wild state, the natural state, the higher animals have a few diseases of little consequence. The main one is old age. But man starts in as a child and lives on diseases till the end, as a regular diet. He has mumps, measles, whooping cough, croup, tonsillitis, diphtheria, scarlet fever, almost as a matter of course. Afterwards, as he goes along, his life continues to be threatened at every turn by colds, coughs, asthma, bronchitis, itch, cholera, cancer, consumption, yellow fever, bilious fever, typhus fevers, hay fever, ague, piles, inflammation of the entrails, indigestion, toothache, earache, deafness, dumbness, blindness, influenza, chickenpox, cowpox, smallpox, liver complaint, constipation, bloody flux, warts, pimples, boils, carbuncles, abscesses, bunions, corns, tumors, fistulas, pneumonia, softening of the brain, melancholia, and 15 other kinds of insanity. Dysentery, jaundice, diseases of the heart, the bones, the skin, the scalp, the spleen, the kidneys, the nerves, the brain, the blood, scrofula, paralysis, leprosy, neuralgia, palsy, fits, headache, 13 kinds of rheumatism, 46 of gout, and a formidable supply of gross and unprintable disorders of one sort or another. Also, but why continue the list? The mere names of the agents appointed to keep this shackly machine out of repair would hide him from sight if printed on this body in the smallest type known to the founder's art. He is but a basket of festering offal provided for the support and entertainment of swarming armies of bacteria, armies commissioned to rot him and destroy him, and each army equipped with a special detail of the work. The process of waylaying him, persecuting him, rotting him, killing him, begins with the first breath, and there is no mercy, no pity, no truce till he draws his last one. Look at the workmanship of him in certain of its particulars. What are his tonsils for? They perform no useful function. They have no value. They have no business there. They are but a trap. They have but one office, the one industry, to provide tonsillitis and quinsy and such things for the possessor of them. And what is the vermiform appendix for? It has no value. It cannot perform any useful service. It is but an ambuscaded enemy whose sole interest in life is to lie in wait for stray grape seeds and employ them to breed strangulated hernia. And what are the male's mammals for? For business, they are out of the question. As an ornament, they are a mistake. What is his beard for? It performs no useful function. It is a nuisance and a discomfort. All nations hate it. All nations persecute it with the razor. And because it is a nuisance and a discomfort, nature never allows the supply of it to fall short in any man's case between puberty and the grave. You never see a man bald-headed on his chin. But his hair? It is a graceful ornament. It is a comfort. It is the best of all protections against certain perilous ailments. Man prizes it above emeralds and rubies. And because of these things, nature puts it on half the time so that it won't stay. Man's sight, smell, hearing, sense of locality, how inferior they are. The condor sees a corpse at 5 miles. Man has no telescope that can do it. The bloodhound follows a scent that is 2 days old. The robin hears the earthworm burrowing his course under the ground. The cat, deported in a closed basket, finds its way home again through 20 miles of country which it has never seen. Certain functions lodged in the other sex perform in a lamentably inferior way as compared with the performance of the same functions of the higher animals. In the human being, menstruation, gestation, and parturition are terms which stand for horrors. In the higher animals, these things are hardly even inconveniences. For style, look at the Bengal tiger, that ideal of grace, beauty, physical perfection, majesty. And then look at man, the poor thing. He is the animal of the wig, the trepanned skull, the ear trumpet, the glass eye, the pasteboard nose, the porcelain teeth, the silver windpipe, the wooden leg, a creature that is mended and patched all over from top to bottom. If he can't get renewals of his bric-a-brac in the next world, what will he look like? He has just one stupendous superiority. In his intellect, he is supreme. The higher animals cannot touch him there. It is curious, it is noteworthy, that no heaven has ever been offered him wherein his one sole superiority was provided with a chance to enjoy itself. Even when he himself has imagined a heaven, he has never made provision in it for intellectual joys. It is a striking omission. It seems a tacit confession that heavens are provided for the higher animals alone. This is matter for thought and for serious thought, and it is full of a grim suggestion that we are not as important, perhaps, as we had all along supposed we were. So that is the end of that, and I really encourage you to pick up this book so that you can read more of these treats, more of these essays, and some more stories. So again, the book is called Mark Twain's Book of Animals, and you can find it at our store on Amazon, which you can get to through CompassionateCooks.com. For the animals, both human and mostly non-human. Just kidding. This is Colleen with Compassionate Cooks. Thank you for listening.